Hello and welcome to the Politics Home podcast. I'm Matt Honeycomb-Foster, news editor here at Politics Home. Boris Johnson has finally published the long-awaited opening gambit for talks on Britain's future relationship with the EU. And Number 10 are clearly trying to show that they can take it or leave it on that big, ambitious trade deal. For all the high-minded talk of friendly cooperation, it's clear the gloves are off, and the Vote Leave vow to take back control is going to guide Downing Street's approach. But is the PM really serious about walking away from the talks if there's no progress by June, even if it means big upheaval for business? Has he gone back on his promises to Brussels, or does his thumping election majority since it was signed change the game? Is there any room for manoeuvre, or is Britain heading back into what we once called no-deal territory in the long-forgotten days of 2019? Who better to guide us through all the details than Laura Hutchinson? Laura is Principal Political Consultant on Brexit and Foreign Affairs for Dodds Monitoring, so she spends a lot of time thinking about the UK's future relationship with the EU and has been poring over the negotiation positions of both sides. Welcome back to the podcast, Laura.
Hello.
And of course, we're joined by a man who's stormed out of his fair share of high-profile meetings, usually any time I suggest a story idea. The esteemed editor of Poll Home, Kevin Schofield. That was carefully scripted, wasn't it?
It was.
But hilarious.
I'm fully authorised by myself, so thanks very much.
I get all my jokes signed off by Kevin in advance. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Matt.
So, later in the pod, we'll also be catching up on all the latest in the very long Labour leadership race, and we'll ask if anything can stop Keir Starmer at this point. But first, arguably the biggest news of the week, all they're talking about down the pub, has been the publication of the snappily titled The Future Relationship with the EU, the UK's Approach to Negotiations. This 30-page tome spells out how Britain is going to approach talks on its post-Brexit ties with the remaining EU27 member states. And Kevin, what was the kind of big headline-grabbing part of this document?
Well, you mentioned it at the top there. Essentially, it's this threat that unless reasonable progress has been made, basically if the easy stuff hasn't been agreed by June, there's a high-level meeting, a stock-taking exercise due in June, and if the UK government decides that not enough progress has been made by then, they'll just walk away, is what they're saying. Which, you know, some might see that as an empty threat, but, you know, it doesn't really get the negotiations off to a fantastic start when one side is already talking about leaving within 3 months.
Laura, how significant a shift is this? Was it a bit of a surprise to see Number 10 come out with that pretty bullish line?
No, not really. I mean, we had the election, obviously, like a few months ago, in which the government position on Brexit was pretty, well, it was clear at parts, confusing every time Boris Johnson sort of made an appearance and tried to comment on it, and things got a bit confused. But no, the 31st of December deadline's always been there. They wrote it into a withdrawal agreement bill that they wouldn't extend. The June deadline that Kevin's talking about, so there's always been a summit in June in the withdrawal agreement. But what they're suggesting now is that they're just going to walk away if progress hasn't been made. It's probably not that surprising, but whether they'll do it is unclear.
How do you think this kind of ultimatum is going to be perceived in Brussels? Because we've also seen real attempt to kind of shrug off parts of the political declaration that was signed by the two sides before the election.
Yeah, I mean, the political declaration thing is quite extraordinary. Like, it is non-binding, but that doesn't mean that it's not a very serious commitment that the UK government entered into.
I mean, he signed it.
The
Prime Minister actually
signed
this piece of paper, and now they're just talking about ripping it up.
Yeah, it's not a good start to the negotiations, which don't actually formally start until Monday. So it sort of just sets things on very, like, it enters into bad faith on both sides. Like, what the UK want basically is as many non-binding, legally non-binding arrangements with the EU. They're not going to give any of them if they don't think the UK can even stick to non-legally binding ones, like the political declaration. So that's an extraordinary thing to do. I don't think sort of like the hardline approach really works with the EU. Their red lines are always going to remain the same with the single market, customs union. Regardless of sort of like how big Boris Johnson's majority is or sort of how bullish he is in the negotiations, those things are rigid. They're not negotiable. So I don't think the hardline approach is going to work with the EU.
Kevin, what's the thinking inside Number 10 on breaking from the political declaration like this?
Well, they're basically saying, look, it's a new regime. Theresa May had a different approach. She wanted to be as conciliatory as possible. I mean, to be fair, it was a much more confused approach. She tried to appeal to her Eurosceptics while at the same time trying to keep the EU on side. And obviously, we know how that ended. The whole thing just collapsed in and itself. And what the UK are saying is, look, we've had a general election on a message of get Brexit done. You know exactly where Boris Johnson is coming from when it comes to Brexit. You know, he helped lead the Vote Leave campaign. He doesn't want close alignment with EU rules and regulations. And regardless what's in the political declaration, that is the reality of the situation. So if you want to avoid no deal, although the UK government no longer call it no deal, but if you want to avoid us basically just walking away and end up trading on World Trade Organization terms, then you're going to have to move towards our way of thinking. And, you know, as Laura says, there's no sign that Brussels is willing to contemplate that.
Laura, the government in the document yesterday explicitly talks about, I think it might be the first time it's been specifically put down in writing, an Australian-style relationship if things don't go its way by June. That's the kind of path they'll go down. Not all of our listeners will be across all trade deals ever signed. So what does an Australia-style relationship mean in practice? And is there kind of any reason for the European Union to fear Britain going down that route?
Yeah, Australia, I mean, it's an odd term basically to refer to no deal. The EU does not have a trade deal with Australia. So when they're talking about an Australian-style relationship, that's crashing out on WTO terms. That's what that means. It's just an odd phrase.
Which means, in real terms, you know, tariffs on goods where at the moment there are no tariffs, so prices go up in shops.
Exactly.
Essentially.
Yeah, it's there's like the sting of no deal has been cauterised slightly in that there's now this Northern Ireland protocol, so there won't be a hard border on the island of Ireland, which is what sort of obviously the EU really feared. So that's been taken away because that will come into place regardless of whether we crash out without a deal or not. But the economic impact of leaving on WTO terms for this country is very significant. It'll be very disruptive, but yeah, that's what is meant by an Australian-style deal. But it's just, I think they've banned no deal
and they've banned Brexit. So you know, that's what Tory MPs have been told, that they can't mention that anymore. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous. It's like, almost like, you know what, if you don't say the word, then it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just farcical.
Yeah, the reality is still the same.
So we saw Michael Gove up in the comments yesterday, and he seemed to suggest that the UK would go down the route of hiring, you know, potentially tens of thousands of customs officers to make this route work. What would need to be in place, what would businesses need for this Australia-style or no-deal-style relationship to actually, to make a success of it, to coin a terrible phrase?
So he committed sort of off the cuff to 5,000 new customs officers being hired, trained and in place by the end of this year. So he might regret saying that commitment in the House yesterday. But so what would be required to leave on no deal terms? It's hard to sort of really list, really. I mean, it would be what we're trying to do already is unstitch ourselves from a union that we've been a member of for nearly 50 years. That in itself is a huge task. So to leave on sort of with an agreement in place, that still requires like a new immigration system, customs, sort of checks, paperwork for the island of Ireland. Even though Boris Johnson saying that wouldn't be the case, it is going to be required. So that in itself is a huge change for business. No deal is sort of hard to fathom, really. I mean, it would be sort of us crashing out on every single sort of economic agreement we are currently entered into overnight.
What really struck me yesterday was that, so they had a briefing in Downing Street yesterday for journalists where they gave us this document, this mandate of what the UK is looking for. And what the message that really came across was, you know, business is a secondary consideration. The economy, the well-being of the economy is a secondary consideration. It's all about sovereignty.
Yeah.
It's all about taking back control, you know, the Vote Leave mantra. As long as we've got control of our money, laws and borders, that's all that matters. The economy, well, yeah, the economy, it's going to get a bit bumpy. Businesses are going to find it very difficult. Trading, there's going to be friction now in trading. They're admitting that openly. But, you know, the main thing is sovereignty, which, you know, for a Conservative government to make the economy and the well-being of business a secondary consideration is quite extraordinary. I mean, this is people's jobs we're talking about. This is prices in the shops we're talking about. But they think that is literally a price worth paying as long as we can control our own laws.
And you can definitely tell it from the mandate that was published yesterday. There was like a bit of, there was a tiny paragraph in it about business, and it was definitely like an afterthought that they just added it in about this consultation.
Yeah, which is the economic, an economic impact
it's
assessment.
Ridiculous.
So basically every major government policy usually comes with an economic impact assessment. So MPs and the public know what the impact on the economy is going to be of a policy. Now, this is a massive economic shift. We're leaving a huge trading block, and they're not going to publish an economic impact assessment, presumably because they know that it will be bad. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter. They're just going to go ahead. As you say, they're going to have a consultation on it. Big deal. Who cares? And yeah,
they're going to have a consultation to wait and see how it goes. Late spring as well, whilst threatening to leave in June. And they're going to consult business on a deal that hasn't been negotiated yet. Like,
I mean, the one thing you can say is at least business know where they stand on their own.
Yeah.
You know, they're just being left to go on with it. It's like, this is a new reality, deal with it.
Yeah.
Which is a remarkable shift from previous Conservative government.
Yeah, definitely.
Could there be trouble ahead for the Prime Minister from his own backbenches here if he goes down this route? Or is this, you know, this is his party now, this is a Brexiteer party, and
they're
willing to make that trade-off of sovereignty over ease of trade.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, the European Research Group, the ERG group, who made Theresa May's life a misery, they're going to be loving this, surely. You know, this is exactly what they wanted. It's all about sovereignty, as far as they're concerned, and that's exactly what he's pledging to give them. And there was an optimistic, I think, view amongst some pro-EU Tories that because he had this big majority, he could afford to annoy the ERG, so he could actually go for a softer Brexit, ironically. But there is absolutely zero indication. And as long as Dominic Cummings, as long as you've got people like Dominic Cummings around him in number 10, they're not going to let him go soft. You know, it's the hardest possible Brexit they can get away with. Mm. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that attitude survives the negotiations, because obviously there is going to have to be compromise. But, you know, if they remain as bullish and as determined to just basically walk away unless they get what they want, then we could be heading for serious trouble.
Laura, was there anything else in that document yesterday that might have sort of slipped under the radar? Any you know, juicy details that we didn't know before? Or was it pretty much what we expected?
I mean, there was stuff that sort of went unnoticed in the chamber and some of the commentary around like security.
Okay.
So, like Kevin said, for the Conservatives to turn their back on business is an extraordinary thing. But they've also, this is the party that's sort of self-identifying the party of law and order. Mm. And in the agreement yesterday, they said they had the mandate yesterday, they have no intention of maintaining being in Europol, in being a member of the European arrest warrant system. So these are big security issues, arrangements that just the government have just said, no, we're not going to be part of that because that involves a slight relationship with the ECJ, which is just unpalatable to the ERG and other Brexiteers. So they're going to just exit these very, very successful security databases. But
Kevin, how much of this do you think was kind of opening bluster and rhetoric? Or are they deadly serious about going down this route?
Well, like I said, you know, they seemed serious at this briefing yesterday. You know, it was with, because it was all off the record, I can't say who was there, but it was very senior people who were going to be involved in these negotiations. And they appeared serious, and they are true believers in the Brexit cause. So, as I say, there is always, on both sides, setting out opening positions. So you've got the EU saying, you know, we won't agree to a deal at any cost, is what Michel Barnier said this week. You know, if you want access to single market and customs union, you're going to have to align with our rules and regulations. So that's their opening gambit. You've got the UK government's opening gambit now as well, which is equally strident at the other end of the spectrum. So you've got to imagine, in all usual negotiations, there is a bit of sort of coming together and compromise, but at the moment they're miles apart, and it's hard to see how that gets bridged in what is basically a few short weeks.
Now we're into week 764 of the Labour leadership race, and there are just 259 left to go. Yep, it is still going on. Kevin, what's Boyd Keir Starmer's team this week?
Another poll came out, YouGov poll for Sky News, which put him miles in front, suggested he's going to win on the first round of ballots, which means he's got more than 50% of first preference. I think it's 53%. Mm. Miles in front of Rebecca Long-Bailey, who I think was at 36%, was her figure, and then 36 or 37, and then Lisa Nandy on 16, so she's miles back, and even though she's earning quite a lot of plaudits for her performance in hustings, and her campaign has been pretty impressive, she doesn't seem to be having enough cut through. So yeah, that's why everyone now is working on the assumption that Keir Starmer is definitely going to be the next leader of the Labour Party.
Laura, how are the numbers looking for the other candidates at the moment? They are pretty much... is it looking like Starmer will just romp into victory?
So it was a YouGov poll, and I don't think they've actually got one wrong.
Okay.
So a Labour leadership election anyway. So, yeah, Keir, they've got him winning in the first round. Deputy, which is also going on at the moment, they've got Rayner winning in the second round, and Richard Bergen... in second place, and Ian Murray, which I think is extraordinary, coming last.
Mm. Well, it's quite interesting. I think the thing you look out for, and I'm not going to claim this as my brilliant analysis. It was Sienna Rogers from Labour List who I think pointed this out on Twitter. The actually interesting thing to look for is the Richard Bergen number and the Ian Murray number, because the Richard Bergen number is going to be your hardcore Corbynites, so that will tell you who in the Labour Party is still, you know, absolutely committed to the Corbyn cause. And the Ian Murray number will tell you basically who's left of the Blairites, of the kind of New Labour lot. And at the moment, I think that poll had him on 9%,
9%.
Which, I mean, if you want to put an optimistic spin on it for Blairites, it would be double what Liz Kendall got in 2015. She got 4.5%. But yeah, it just shows exactly, I think, where the centre of political gravity is within the Labour Party at the moment.
In that poll as well, they asked, one of the questions was, imagine if Jeremy Corbyn was standing in this election and they still had Keir Starmer winning.
Which was interesting. Although it's remarkable that he would still come second, wouldn't he? Jeremy Corbyn would come second. He just led the Labour Party to its worst election since 1935 and would still come second if he stood
again. I mean, they are determined on electing a male, so...
yeah, that's true.
Rather a man who's not standing than an actual woman. Rebecca Long-Bailey has not had a massive amount of cut-through in this campaign. There haven't really been any big moments, I don't think, where she's looked like she's kind of the runaway favourite. But this week she's gained quite a bit of coverage with a move to reveal her own donors, and kind of outriders in her campaign have challenged the other candidates to do the same. Who's bankrolling her campaign, first of all, Kevin? And kind of was that a smart move, do you think, by the RLB camp?
Well, it's mainly Unite. The union have given her £200,000 in cash, plus another £15,000 in staff costs, so that's a donation in kind. Momentum have given £100,000 worth of staffing. The FBU have given a few grand. CWU. So, I mean, it's mainly unions are bankrolling it, which again gives weight to this theory that she's the continuity Corbyn candidate, which she obviously denies. So, yeah, it was no surprise, really, I think, where her money was coming from. But it was the fact that she did it was quite interesting, I think, because they realised that their campaign is in trouble. And the best hope they've got is trying to convince people that Keir Starmer is actually, you know, a Blairite in Corbyn clothing. Because Keir has tried to make himself quite left-wing. And I think he is a left-wing, actually. But, you know, he's been really, really playing up his left-wing credentials. And the best hope the Long-Bailey campaign have got is by trying to paint him as a fraud. Now, they're putting pressure on him to reveal his donors. Now, it's quite interesting because he hasn't done it. Mm. And there is a suspicion that there might be one or two names on there who he would not want to come out at this stage. Maybe, and I'm just speculating here, maybe people who might have supported Tony Blair in the past or New Labour or something like that. I don't know if that's the case, but it does... You can see why people are maybe a little bit suspicious. Lisa Nandy, last night, the other candidate, she... piled further pressure on Keir Starmer by publishing her own list of donors. It's nowhere near as much money as Rebecca Long Bailyn, certainly not as much as Keir Starmer. But again, that was all aimed at highlighting the fact that Keir Starmer hasn't done it. His camp are adamant they won't do it. They won't be forced into doing it. They say they're abiding by all the rules and regulations. They're passing on the details to the parliamentary authorities, and it'll be published on the Commons Register of Interest probably next week. But they're certainly in no rush to certainly be forced into doing it.
Someone else who's been worth watching this week has been Angela Rayner. She's directly criticised Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, really the first time that she's come out and done that. What did she say, and what do you think she's kind of playing at here?
Yeah, well, what was really interesting about that is, the thing is, Angela Rayner, some people have worked on the assumption that Angela Rayner was a bit of a Corbynite, you know, and she was loyal to Jeremy Corbyn, didn't take part in the coup to get rid of him or anything like that, but actually privately was always pretty critical of Jeremy Corbyn. But this is the first time she's gone public with those concerns, saying that the public didn't trust him on security, he didn't really have any cut through as far as the public were concerned. And it was just quite noticeable, because certainly in the leadership campaign, the candidates have all been falling over themselves to praise Jeremy Corbyn by saying, you know, the policies in the manifesto were great, maybe it was just the way they were presented, we shouldn't move away from Corbynism, he sort of rediscovered the soul of the party, turned Labour into an anti-austerity party, etc, etc. So to see a candidate, albeit one in the deputy leadership, actually openly criticise Jeremy Corbyn was interesting, because, you know, we still think that probably around about a third to a half of Labour members are still very supportive of Jeremy Corbyn. So she's taking a bit of a risk, but I guess she's probably looking at those numbers that I mentioned earlier. She sees she's miles in front and can probably afford to annoy a few Corbynites.
Now, Kevin, you've got to dash off to lobby very, very shortly, so I'm going to rattle through a few listeners' questions.
Right, okay.
So Nick Beale asks, what has been your favourite lobby experience, Kevin?
Do you think he's asked this because I'm leaving?
You're breaking our listeners' hearts as you say that.
I'm sure they know already.
We could have been more gentle with
it's
that.
It's just
I
a
think.
Strange question.
I'll put a warning at the top of the pod.
Yeah.
Some sad news contained within. You are moving on to Pastures New, aren't you, Kevin?
I am, yes, yes.
What has been the best thing about being in the lobby, apart from working with
Well,
me?
Obviously, that's taken as read, obviously. I think I would say probably the foreign trips, if I'm being really shallow.
Fair enough. Not
had them so many since I came to Politics Home, but and my previous guys at The Sun, I had some great trips. I went to the Falklands. I was at the Daily Record. I went to the White House with Gordon Brown, which was good fun. Been to quite a few countries in Africa. Where else have I been? Yeah, it was just great fun. Just have that level of access, you know, to senior politicians and getting paid for it. I'm sort of nothing. That's a bit boring.
That's good.
I've got no specific anecdotes really. But it's been a good ride. That's for sure.
Just to correct the record, you have been to Birmingham with Paul Home. I think you've been to a few conferences.
I've certainly been to a lot of comedy. I wouldn't say that party conferences were ever a highlight of my time in political journalism, but they're things to be endured rather than enjoyed. But I have also been. I did get to go to America when I was at Politics Home. Theresa May's first trip after Donald Trump got elected. So that was quite good fun. I was in the White House at that time as well. So yeah, it's pretty. I mean, you do appreciate how lucky you are. Most normal people don't get the chance to do the stuff that we do. So it's a great privilege.
Kevin has gone. He's swanned off. He's abandoned his post. That's what it's going to be like now for the next few months.
Just you by yourself.
No, you're still here. So Laura is still here. We've got a few more questions from our loyal listeners slash colleagues. So, Gwyn, our colleague, asks, tell me your fantasy Whitehall restructure.
Oh my God.
What would you do if you were Dominic Cummings? You could
if
wave
I was
a magic,
Dominic
yeah,
Cummings.
What would you do if you were Dominic Cummings? You could wave a magic wand and change the shape of the UK government. What would you
I don't know, really. I mean, probably put some more money into Whitehall.
Okay.
Rather than restructure every department. The FCO, I think, should take the lead with Brexit negotiations. I think they always should have from the very beginning. I'm not sure what the purpose of creating DECSU really was when you had quite skilled diplomats and negotiators concentrated in the FCO. There was sort of, you know, they should have led it. I don't have a fantasy Whitehall restructure thing.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? God, what's wrong with you? So I once wrote an April Fool's story. This is the kind of...
What's an April Fool's story? Oh, like a...
are the kind of kicks I had at Civil Service World, my previous job. I wrote an April Fool's story about merging DCMS, the Culture Department, with the Ministry of Defence, with the MOD. It was our most read story that day. Okay. Probably most read than anything I'd actually ever worked on
that
was true.
Think that happened.
So that's good. So that would be my fantasy one, because it'd just be weird combination. You've got tanks and you've got, like, you know, fun.
I'm not sure that's the purpose.
Culture and guns.
Yeah, okay.
The culture and guns brief.
Yeah.
So one final question from Andy.
Yeah.
Andy says, after Rebecca Long Bailey revealed her karaoke choices this week,
did she?
What would be your go-to songs? Shall we share Rebecca Long Bailey? So this was in a really fantastic...
Things Can Only Get Better.
It wasn't Things Can Only Get Better. So Rebecca Long Bailey did a WhatsApp interview with Hannah Al-Othman from BuzzFeed, which was actually really good. It was very chatty and kind of personable.
Okay.
And there was some tough questions in there as well, but she did ask, what's your go-to karaoke song? And Rebecca Long Bailey replied, I have a few. Run DMC, It's Tricky. Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight. House of Pain, Jump Around. And she said, these are all rap songs because I can't sing. It's not fair on people to put them through that. Laura, what would you put people through?
Okay.
People appreciate her rap skills, but she's just not got... She's not got the dulcet tones.
Okay, I don't have a favourite. I'm really, really boring. I really hate, I sort of fear
actively
karaoke.
Fear.
Yeah, okay. It's my nightmare.
If you were forced by the
merged
Ministry of Defence and DCMS at gunpoint to have fun, and this is laboured, isn't it? To do some karaoke, what would you say?
I would have Things Can Only Get Better, because that's the only song I can currently think of.
Things Can Only Get Better. Yeah. That is the anthem of the 97 Blair victory.
97.
By Dee Ream.
Yeah.
Brian Cox on keyboards.
Which Brian Cox? There's quite a few.
Brian Cox, the space one.
Okay. The space one?
The space Brian Cox was the keyboardist in Dee Ream.
Wow.
There you go. You see, you laugh and you learn when you listen to the Pole Home podcast. And on that fantastic note, that is all we've got time for on the Pole Home podcast this week. We've just about held that one together. Please keep your questions coming in. We love to try our best to answer them. Sometimes we even get to the point. If you want to keep up with everything we're doing in the week, you can sign up to our free 7-day-a-week breakfast briefing email, which has all the day's top stories in your inbox around about 7 o'clock every morning. So until next week, have a good one. So speaking of actual women, that's a weird thing to say, let's cut that out, kill me, so I don't know where I go from that now.